Welcome into the Towel Boys. He's Mike Grimala over at RunRevs.com. I'm Tyler Bischoff over here at Mountain West Connection. Transfers and basically Nigel Williams-Goss not coming to UNLV. He's going to Gonzaga. Ike Wamu from Mercer is coming to UNLV. So Dave Rice gets one of the two big transfer targets that he was after. So we'll get to Ike. We're going to start with Nigel Williams-Goss, though, going to Gonzaga. For a little bit there, I saw people saying that he was down to UNLV in Providence, but then he was taking trips to Gonzaga, and supposedly he was taking one to Ohio State. I don't know if he ever did. But really, those were kind of the last four schools in the mix. Ends up going to Gonzaga. Is it a big deal that Nigel Williams-Goss doesn't come to UNLV?
I wouldn't say it's a huge deal because he wasn't going to be eligible next year anyways. So you're not going to feel the impact of this for a couple years anyways. So I wouldn't say that it's a huge miss. I don't think missing on any transfer can really be a huge miss. But it would have been nice. He did fit the roster. I thought he fit the roster pretty well in terms of timing and position. I thought that it was a guy that they definitely could have used. So I'd hesitate to say that it was a huge miss and it's going to really hurt. But I do think there was an opportunity there that they weren't able to sort of cash in on and bring him in.
Yeah, I kind of don't view it as a huge miss because Dave Rice wasn't like in need of him immediately. And he's not going to be eligible next year, so you couldn't have really been counting on him. But there was no, like, Dave Rice, this might be his last year. And if he doesn't win now, like, he might be done. So he wasn't counting on Nigel Williams-Goss to do that, to help him win this year. So I don't view it as a big miss. And, you know, if you've listened to our two previous podcasts, I am much higher on Ike Wamu than I am on Nigel Williams-Goss. I would take 1 year of Wamu over 2 years of Williams-Goss. He's a very talented point guard. He had, like, the second-best assist percentage in the Pac-12, but that's literally the only advanced stat that likes Nigel Williams-Goss. His total numbers are pretty good. His per-game numbers are really good, but his percentages and his advanced stats are below average. He's not a very efficient scorer, doesn't have a good shot chart, doesn't shoot the ball well from three, and takes a lot of mid-range jumpers. As I said before, I would like him on the team, but I would not like him as my number one offensive option. So, to me, while I still would have taken him on UNLV, because he's still a very talented guy, and you could project, you know, in a year or two that he would be your second or third option, potentially, and I think that's where he would fit a lot better. But if I'm UNLV right now, I am happier that I got Ike Wamu than I am upset that I missed out on Nigel Williams-Goss.
And Nwamu is a guy who should make a pretty big impact right away, not only because he can, not only because he'll be eligible immediately next year, but because he should fit into the lineup pretty well. He should see like a lot of minutes, and he should play a pretty prominent role starting next season.
RebelNet tweeted in regards to Williams-Goss, UNLV bungled things a month ago, and it created understandable doubt. NGW more likely without UNLV fumbling and bumbling upstairs. I guess my question is, what the hell did they bungle? Like, what? Take me back to the right after the season ended. What did UNLV, and this is kind of directed at Tina Kunzer-Murphy, what did they do so bad?
It's just the fact that, I guess, that you're evaluating Dave Rice and you're sort of on the fence about bringing him back, but the fact that, I mean, which is your right. If you're the athletic director, that's within your right to evaluate people and to, you know, make those decisions. The problems come when you make it so public and you let everyone know, including prospective players who are thinking about coming to the school, you let them know that, you know, you're on the fence about your head coach. And that sort of puts doubt in the minds of these players that, hey, especially a guy like Nigel Williams-Goss, who had he committed, he wouldn't have been able to play for 2 years, you know, so Dave Rice has to survive, you know, two seasons until, you know, so he might not even, Nigel's thinking is, hey, this guy, he might not even be the head coach by the time I can actually play for this school. So if you're making the whole process public like that, I guess some people would categorize that as, you know, bungling the process.
I completely understand if Nigel Williams-Goss was like, this is sort of a make-or-break year for Dave Rice. I'm going to be sitting out. I can't even impact this season in a major way other than, like, practicing hard. I understand if he saw that and thought, okay, Dave Rice, like, literally might be fired and I'll be playing for a coach that I have no clue who he is the next when I finally become eligible at UNLV. I understand that. I don't believe that Nigel Williams-Goss was paying close enough attention, and even if he was, cared enough that for, I mean, and what, like, what was the timeline? The season ended on what, a Wednesday or a Thursday against San Diego State? It was a Wednesday or Thursday, and then, like, that weekend, or maybe it was Friday, TKM gave a quote that basically said, you know, to sum it up, it was like, we don't know if we're bringing Dave back. We're going to review it, and we're going to talk to him the start of next week. So, like, it was like a 4 or 5 day period where basically she said, we don't know what we're going to do. We're going to review the situation and talk to Dave. And to me, like, everybody thinks they just, like, I don't understand how that's screwing it up. Like, I get that you want your athletic director to be like, I don't know, 100% in her decision-making and vindictive, but I have no problem with an athletic director saying, hey, I'm going to take some time to think about this and talk to Dave Rice, because obviously this last year wasn't where we want to be, but obviously we have positive things. Look, what was screwed up so badly? And you said making it public. She made just one quote to, right? It was just one quote that people got all pissy
about. But even that, like, that's one quote like that. It sets off so much doubt. Like, I can understand where I don't have any firsthand knowledge that there did directly impact Nigel's thinking, but I think that's enough to affect recruiting, definitely. I mean, we saw in the aftermath that some recruits, you know, followed it a little more closely. Some recruits didn't follow that whole saga very closely. Maybe he was a guy who was following it, but I think that's enough. Like, what her quote, like, even one quote, once that gets into the media, then it becomes bigger, and then it's something that's covered every day, and it does become big news. So once that's out in the public, it can have a pretty big impact, even if it is just one quote. And by making it public, you make it an issue with recruiting.
So if we're going back in time, and if you're advising her, like, would you tell her just not to give any quote at all?
As a member of the media, you want them to be as truthful as possible. But if I was, you know, her PR assistant, I'd say, if someone asks you what you're going to do with Dave Rice, you say, hey, we're just going to have we're going to have a meeting after the season, like we do at the end of every season, and that you leave it at that. You don't have to say, you know, where whatever she said. I don't remember the exact quote, but they definitely had a tone where he was not completely safe.
Yeah, I mean, it implied that they were open to firing him. I mean, absolutely. But I don't, like, yeah, I guess it would have been better public relation-wise and perception-wise if she had given a more neutral quote. But to me, I just really don't think they did anything that just was awful, and they could have you using the word bungled or fumbling and bumbling. Like, what's the problem with an athletic director taking a couple days to figure something out? Nothing. I guess if you, like, literally the only problem is she made a quote saying, hey, we're not sure if we're bringing him back. Like, I don't know. I just don't see that as some big sin that is going to be held over UNLV and getting a transfer or not.
Yeah. It varies from person to person. Like, it may affect some people. It may not affect other guys. They may not pay attention to that kind of stuff. Like Derek Jones said, like, he paid no attention. He was committing to the school. Maybe Nigel Williams-Goss is a guy who was committing to the coach. I don't know. I don't know if it was bungled. I know it definitely wasn't handled as well as it could be. Did it cost them Nigel Williams-Goss? Who knows?
How badly, if you're UNLV, would you want Nigel?
I think that he was a good fit for the point guard position 2 years from now, and he had 2 years of eligibility left. I'm not sure that there's a better option for the 2016-17 season. Anyone that they would recruit now would be, you know, they're recruiting freshmen for 2016. So anyone who's going to be in that position 2 years from now is going to be, you know, a true freshman or a converted guy that's currently on the roster, like a McCaw. Daquan Cook technically will be a senior that year, but I don't know how much you want to expect from him. So unless you get a really good freshman in the class of 2017, you're expecting him to be a big-time player as a freshman and as a sophomore. I don't know if they can get anyone that would have been better than Nigel Williams-Goss those 2 years.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to look at it, just that point guard in those 2 years, who's it going to be? What are the chances you think Nigel Williams-Goss never plays for Gonzaga and goes pro after sitting out, or plays 1 year and goes pro rather than using his 2 years of eligibility?
I think there's there is a possibility. When he announced his transfer, you're reading some of the local media from up in the Northwest, and they were mentioning, you know, that the question as the season was winding down was whether he would go to the NBA. So when he announced that he was transferring instead, that was kind of a surprise because they thought the most likely option was that he was going to turn pro instead. So, I mean, there is a chance. It would be a kind of a weird situation if he turned pro after a redshirt year. I don't know if I know that's happened in football a few times. I'm not sure if I can think of it happening in basketball. I don't think it's a huge possibility that he would leave before playing.
Do you know off the top of your head where he would be projected in the draft?
I don't at all guess. Okay. He's not like a lottery pick type.
Yeah. I was wondering if he's kind of Rashad Vaughn territory right now, like mid second round, or if he's actually like late first round type guy. I don't have any idea. I was just curious as to what his options are, because in all honesty, he could have come to UNLV, and if Dave Rice gets fired, he could just say, okay, I'm going to go pro. But that's probably not the best idea after you sat out a whole year and didn't play. But all right, turning to Ike Wamu, he picks UNLV. Mike texted me, was it Saturday or was it Friday, saying that you knew he was committing to UNLV based on his tweets?
I think it was Friday or Saturday after whenever his second tweet came out with his... His first tweet was Tuscan Leather, which is the song with the UNLV lyrics. And then the second tweet was the Gucci logo, which is like a...
And that sealed it.
Obviously a reference
to Gucci. Because he put the picture in it, too.
Yeah. If you're attaching media, that means you're like putting thought into it. I thought that was pretty... that was pretty obvious. I was ready to roll with that.
Okay, before we get into Ike Wamu and him at UNLV, what in the hell is he thinking with putting that tweet out during halftime of Game 7 on Saturday? Like, he is literally the 15th biggest story in Las Vegas sports on Saturday.
Halftime of the biggest Game 7 of the NBA playoffs so far, and during the undercard of Mayweather-Pacquiao. So, like, run the lead up to that fight when there are, like, zero eyeballs on the UNLV recruiting at that point.
It was I don't know what he was thinking. I don't know if he was waiting on whoever to Photoshop that picture of him in a UNLV jersey and he finally got it to him and he just wanted to get it. I don't know, but that was like, what the hell? Like, literally, if you were trying to maximize attention, and maybe he did it on purpose, maybe he didn't want the attention, but I don't think you tweet out a Photoshop picture of yourself if you don't want some attention. But if you're trying to maximize attention, you don't do it. Like, that, like, what was it? ESPN was yelling about this was the greatest sporting weekend in history and all this crap. And it's like, okay, it's halftime of Spurs and Clippers. This is a good time to put it out.
You're definitely not getting above the fold on the Sunday, in the Sunday paper, the Sunday sports section yesterday.
Like, it was, like, just at Mountain West Connection, it was probably, like, the 15th most important story because of the NFL draft and all the different Mountain West guys that either got drafted or signed with a team. Like, it was awful. Like, he is in no way was that even close to a top 10 sports story in the city of Las Vegas on Saturday. Not even close. But, okay, beyond that, Ike, and beyond making people on Saturday nights when they're trying to watch Game 7 or boxing write a quick 400-word story about you, what he does for UNLV, to me, the biggest thing, he fills the void in terms of who on this team can get to the rim and score. He's going to be the best at that this coming up season. I don't really think there's anybody else on the roster that's going to really rival that at all either. But he's going to be the best at getting to the rim by himself and finishing at the rim. He's also got a very efficient shot chart. His last 2 years, very different shot chart. His second to last year at Mercer, basically, I think it was like 55% of his shots came at the rim. So basically, more than half his shots were layups or dunks. But this past season, over 50% of his shots were three-pointers. So he started to shoot a lot more threes this last year. Shoots it pretty well. I think he's a career like 39% three-point shooter in the 3 years that he's played already. He played 1 year at Cleveland State, too. So he's a pretty good shooter, can get to the rim, doesn't shoot a ton in the mid-range. I love the guy, and UNLV has a guy on the roster that has scored over 10 points at the college level.
Yeah, which was one of your big question marks, I know, going into the season. It does seem like a really good fit. I'm trying to look up right now. What are his free throw rates in terms of getting to the line?
I do not know. I think when I saw it, I was a little. I think it was lower than I expected when I actually was paying attention to his overall stats.
Okay. Yeah, and it looked like it was a pretty good 2 years ago. Last year, it dropped a little bit. 572 went down to 355 last year. But yeah, he does seem like a guy that can get to the basket, which there are some guys who have the potential to do that that are already on the roster. You know, Pat McCaws or Jordan Cornish, you saw that at times from them this year. But no one that you know can, you know, get there and, you know, put the ball on the floor and collapse the defense and or even score at the rim. Like Pat McCaw, as you mentioned, like when he gets in there, he's looking to pass first and second. He's looking for lobs. He's looking for kickouts. But Nwamu is a guy who can put the ball on the floor and get to the basket, and then he can elevate and still, you know, get good shots off around the rim.
Is he an automatic starter for you?
When I do the next round of roster projections, I'll have him as the starter, as the third guard or small forward, whatever you want to call that position. He'll be the three. I think he fits in there really well. It probably was going to be Cornish or Morgan, like, fighting for that spot, but I think Nwamu takes that job probably heading into practice, into preseason anyways, and sort of slots everyone down a peg.
Is he the top scoring option?
We'll have to see. I still think McCaw is going to have the ball in his hands a lot. I still probably would lean toward McCaw.
If we take McCaw, like, you'd agree, top three, not really in an order, it's McCaw, Nwamu, and Zimmerman.
Yes.
Are going to be the top 3 points per game next year. How those are your top three guys, like, how many points per game do they score? Or what percentage? Like, do they have to be scoring, like, 80% of UNLV's points? Like, do those three have to be putting up 55 between them? Or do you think it's going to be, like, those three are the top guys, but then, you know, Jordan Cornish is going to get 9 a game, or Okonobo is going to get 8 a game, and other guys are going to be kind of close to him? Or do you think it's, like, those are sort of the three elite guys and everybody else is way behind in terms of points per game?
I don't see it being, like, a top-heavy scoring situation where those three are doing most of the scoring. I could see McCaw, like, reasonably up to, like, 15 or 16. I could see Nwamu, you know, 13 or 14. I could see Zimmerman, like, a dozen points a game, something like that. Those are probably conservative guesses. But I can see somewhere in that. So you've got those three guys combining for somewhere around 40, maybe in the low 40 points per game, and then the rest of the crew, like, filling it in.
Okay, so back to the starting lineup. To me, my five would be Seegers, McCaw, Nwamu, Zimmerman, and Okonobo. Is there any chance that Pat McCaw doesn't start next year?
No. I can't see it.
Like, I can't either, like, because of just the way Pat McCaw played last year and what he brings to your team offensively. I think he's got to be the guy that plays the most minutes next year. But it just, like, I just, for some, and the way you phrased it a couple times reading about Pat McCaw is he basically forced Dave Rice to play him more and then forced Dave Rice to start him is essentially what happened because of how well he was playing. I don't know. I can't foresee it, but it's like, for some reason, I just have this feeling that Dave Rice might be like, all right, Seegers is my one, Wamu's my two, I'm going to play Dwayne Morgan as my three, and Pat McCaw is going to be my first guard off the bench because I want a true small forward or something.
I could see maybe another, you could see like if he wanted to appease other players in terms of, you know, the title of being a starter. You know, if he wanted to sort of motivate Dwayne Morgan by saying like, hey, you're a starter or something like that. You know, you say there's a starting spot up for grabs. And if McCaw is the kind of kid who has an attitude where it doesn't matter to him, and, you know, so you can sort of still play him starter's minutes off the bench. And if, you know, if being an official starter doesn't matter to him and you can give that title to someone else and sort of make the entire team sort of more comfortable, like I could see that, but I don't really see a reason to tinker with it. I think that they have I think it's set up pretty nicely with Seegers, McCaw, and Nwamu as the 1, 2, and 3. Unless you want a guard coming off the bench who can, you know, play both spots.
All right, so looking at this team offensively, I've got a question. I'm going to answer it myself. I created this question for myself. Basically, what does UNLV need in terms of sort of skill sets offensively next season, or what do they need to really see from guys that maybe we're unsure of? Because if you look, there's two pieces in McCaw and Wamu, and I love both of them because they both do kind of the two most important things, and that is they can both shoot the ball from three, and they can both draw a help side defender and or score at the rim. Like, to me the key in basketball is to have spacing and have a guy or multiple guys that can draw help defender.
You need someone that can get the defense moving and getting out of place, and you have to make the defense think. You can't just let them sit there and dig in their heels and then just play one-on-one defense for an entire possession. You've got to change things up and, like, force them into some sort of action.
McCaw and Wamu can both do that. I mean, they can both make defenses, rotate a guy over. We've seen McCaw hit either a big man for an alley-oop or kick it out for an open three. Saw that. Wamu, I don't think he passed it as much as you would like to see, but he's certainly a guy that can do it as well. So if I kind of look at skill sets offensively, I want to see Jerome Seegers be able to do that too. Be able to get into the lane and draw a help side defender and either get it to the big underneath for a dunk or get it out to an open three. Because if you're going with Seegers, McCaw, and Wamu, and all three of those guys have the ability to get in the lane and kick out for an open three, all three of them can shoot, and if all three of them can get in the lane and draw a help side defender, like, that could be incredible between those three. So if Seegers can do that, I think the offense is going to be really good. The other thing I want to see from him is to be able to break the press with, like, some comfort. I think... Like last year, Cody Doolin, I think if you actually went and looked at the overall numbers, his turnover percentage probably wasn't awful against, like, presses and stuff like that. But he never gave you confidence that he was going to do it every time. And he never looked like he did it with ease or looked like he did it with comfort. It always looked like it was a pain and it was, like, the hardest thing in the world.
And when even though he did most of the time, you know, get the ball across, like, the defense never really had to worry about getting burned, you know? You can play pressure and you can press him the length of the court without having to worry about him just, you know, zipping by you and all of a sudden it's a 5-on-4, you know?
Yeah. And so with Seegers, can he make it look comfortable? And can he, you know, when he plays San Diego State, can he burn them 4, 5, 6 times a game and get somebody a wide open dunk because they overextend their defense and because they're trying to trap you somewhere or whatever? If he can do that, I think that's probably the biggest thing I'd want to see out of Seegers is his ability to handle press, especially San Diego State's. The other kind of player/skill set I'm looking for is Zimmerman. How well can he handle a post-double? And just kind of goes back to San Diego State again, but any time that he gets doubled in the post or at 10 feet or whatever, can he make the right decision? Can he find the open man? Because if you look at what happened with Chris Wood and San Diego State, three chances against him, progressively got better handling that double team, but it wasn't until the third meeting that UNLV actually made San Diego State pay. And it wasn't all on Chris Wood. There was a lack of movement and good movement from his teammates when he got doubled in the first couple games. But can Zimmerman handle those post doubles? Because that's essentially another case of you've got the defense rotating, you've got guys, you've now got a 4-on-3 situation if you can get the pass out of that double team. So those are really the two big things. Can Zimmerman shoot consistently from 15 feet in the college game? Can he score on the block, or kind of secondary things that you kind of expect him to be able to score in some ways? But to me, Seager's breaking the press and being able to draw some help defense, and then can Zimmerman beat a post-double? If they get those things, that starting five, I think, is going to score really well, and I think they're going to, like, it's going to be an incredible offense. That five-man unit's going to be incredible on offense if they get those things from Seegers and Zimmerman.
Yeah, it's and you can't say enough about, like, how much, like, the fit for Nwamu is enough to, whereas a few weeks ago we were sort of wondering and discussing, like, where the scoring is going to come from, and are they really going to be able to put up enough points, and now with Nwamu on board, and he sort of changes the equation so much so that, like, the potential, you can see it. Like, they can do everything that you have to do to have a good offense.
And I'll say this about Seegers. Even if he doesn't turn out to be a guy, and I think trying to remember off the top of my head, he had pretty good isolation numbers, and one of his last 2 years at Rutgers, he had pretty good pick and roll numbers. But they weren't unbelievable. So he appears to be a guy that can somewhat create and get into the lane. But even if he can't, like, even if he comes UNLV and he is just not a guy that can get into the lane effectively, if he can shoot the ball well, and he had good shooting numbers at Rutgers, if he can shoot it well, it'll still work well because he's got two guys that can get into the lane. So I don't think it's a necessity, but I think the offense just becomes really good if you've got three guards that can get in the lane, three guards that can shoot, and you've got a big guy that can handle a double team and got a big guy that can space the floor a little bit. So, to me, offensively, there's a lot that can be really good. If you kind of look on the next level of scoring, how well does Jordan Corner shoot? Does Dwayne Morgan develop either a better jump shot or a better shot selection, one of the two? What does Derek Jones, Jalen Poyser, what do they bring you as freshmen offensively? And then, you know, does Ben Carter, Goodluck Okunobo, are they able to score on the block, or are you really just looking at them as catch and score off of help side defense or whatever it is? What do you think the best sort of tertiary, or I don't know, maybe we're beyond tertiary at this point, but what do you think out of that group of guys becomes sort of the best offensive skill set that UNLV will have?
I'm intrigued by Cornish. Like, out of those, the secondary players or the bench or the reserves, but I think that he would have been in line for a lot of playing time before the Nwamu addition. I think he's still going to see a lot of time. He was locked in all last season with his shot, but even beyond the shot, I know the numbers don't really bear it out in terms of free throw percentage and his shots at the rim, but I do think he's a guy that once he learns to pump fake and then put the ball on the floor, you know, two dribbles to the basket, I think he's a guy who can also, he may not be able to break his man down one-on-one, out of a set defense, but once you get a defense scrambling around, I think he's a guy who can catch it, pump the charging defender, and get into the lane, and then he's physical enough to, once he's in there, either finish around the rim or even start learning to, you know, collapse the defense again and then, you know, kick it out again. I think Cornish is, I'm high on Cornish. I think that he will develop into a really good offensive player.
Did he shoot enough / shoot well enough that Mountain West coaches starting next year are going to say, shooter, shooter, when he's on the floor and when he catches the ball, and that teams are, like, he's going to be in the scouting report as, this guy shot almost 50% last year, and teams are going to, when they close out, they're going to close out too hard, and he'll have really easy opportunity. Like, do you think he shot enough that coaches are like, oh, hell, we got to get somebody out on him when he catches on the perimeter?
Maybe not by volume. Maybe, it's not like the players probably, he probably won't stick in their minds as, a guy who's going to torch you from the outside. But when the coaches put together their scouting reports next year, he's got to be on it as a shooter. You know, he'll be listed saying, hey, you know, don't wander away from this guy too far. He shot 50% from 3-point on a decent number of attempts. So, like, he may not have been enough of a volume shooter to, like, stick out in people's minds, but they'll be reminded, players, opponents will be reminded before the game, like, hey, don't leave this guy, close out on him, don't let him beat us from 3-point line.
just watching him play, nothing really stuck out that kind of implied that he had, you know, great basketball IQ and really understood. But talking to him, like at media opportunities and stuff, he seems like a guy that understands basketball, right? Like you get that same sense that he seems like a smart player.
Yeah, I get the idea. I feel like you can sort of see it the way he sort of shifts around the perimeter just to get open. From talking to him, I get the sense that he, you know, understands what they wanted from him and, you know, the best way to contribute and all that kind of stuff.
Does he have to bring more defensively next year?
The potential is there. He's the size. Like, that's the first thing you notice about him. For a guy who was, you know, playing a lot of minutes at two guard towards the end of the year, he can carry, like, a lot of weight and a lot of strength on his frame. Like, he's like a big, powerful guy. And that can translate to an advantage on the defensive end once you learn how to harness it and maybe get a little more experience. But, that's all potential at this point. That's even more speculative than, you know, his offensive development.
All right. Still, I guess, offensively, Dwayne Morgan, the two freshmen, Carter, Okonobo, are we expecting a lot on a consistent basis from any of those guys in terms of points, or is it just sort of like score when your man leaves you?
I don't think those guys are going to be asked to do, you know, to carry the offense, you know, more than, you know, possession. Maybe the shot clock's winding down, you ask those guys to make something happen. But, I mean, it seems like they have enough players. They'll always have someone on the court to sort of take charge, don't you think? Like, with like you mentioned, they have three guys. If Seager sort of pans out, they'll have three guys that are sort of capable of taking the reins and, you know, being in charge of, you know, making something happen and initiating that first attack. So, I don't know. Do you think that any of those guys are really going to have to carry that much of a load on offense?
I don't know what to do with Derrick Jones and Jalen Poizer because they're freshmen and haven't seen them play and they're freshmen. And, like, I don't know what to do. But there's a lot of hype behind Derrick Jones because he can dunk. And I don't think they'll be asked to carry it. I think Dwayne Morgan will at times think he's supposed to carry it, but I don't think he's going to be asked to carry it. I don't think Ben Carter is going to be a guy that ever thinks, like, hey, I've got to go get 15 points. But I do. He might be a guy that can, actually. Now, he's never scored more than, like, 2.5 at Oregon, but he might actually be able to go out and get 15 against some teams. But I kind of look at that, and the most important thing to me is Okonobo and Carter scoring when their man commits. And I think Okonobo did a great job of that last year, catching alley-oops and scoring when his man stepped up. I assume Ben Carter can do the same thing. So that, to me, is sort of the biggest thing is basically when the defense is rotating, we hit you, you score. Like, whether you're 5 feet away or whether you're right at the basket, you either dunk it or you knock down the short shot. To me, that's sort of the biggest thing. The rest of it's just kind of, yeah, you'll have some good games from different guys, but nothing else.
Just finish the plays when, you know, you're set up.
Yeah.
I think Okonobo obviously is the athleticism. You know, he can dunk those balls that he gets in the lane. The only question is the free throws. Like, if you're asking him to be like a finisher around the rim, the free throws have to come up.
It's like, how many times per game Okonobo and Ben Carter combined do you think they'll catch the ball on the block in sort of a situation that's either designed or kind of just happens upon, hey, you catch it on the block, go one-on-one and score in this post-up situation?
I think more than most people think. Like, it's not every feed is going to be, you know, directly leading to a dunk, but that's a pretty common result of, you know, a guard getting into the lane. You know, wait, you just lay it down for a big man. He may not be open, but, like, that's one of your outlets.
Yeah, I think you'll get some post-up from them. And I think early, too, because I don't know how much they'll actually rely on Steven Zimmerman to go get them 13, 14 points in the first couple games. But I do think you'll see them catching balls on the block, and maybe one of them does kind of turn into a decent threat there, and that can be your de facto fourth option or whatever. And all of a sudden, you know, Ben Carter gets 4 or 5 touches on the block, and he turns that into 6, 7 points or something like that, and you're good to go in that standpoint. Defensively, as far as me watching basketball, I'm much farther behind trying to figure out defense and who's good at defense than I am on the offensive end. So I don't know how good this team's going to be defensively next year. Like, I don't know how good Seegers is. I don't know how good Wamu is defensively. Like, literally have no clue what those guys bring to the table defensively. Zimmerman, I kind of expect him to block shots. I know what Okonobo can do in terms of blocking shots and also leaving the offensive boards open when he goes to get those shots, but I don't know what to expect from this team defensively, because I'm really high on the offensive end, but I'm still not going to be high on, like, this team's going to win a lot of games, because I don't know what to do with them defensively.
Yeah, and it's the defensive rebounding is going to be an issue until they prove it's not. Wood leaving, you know, it's just a big hole. You're hoping Zimmerman can fill most of that, and then Carter has a pretty good reputation as a rebounder. Okonobo is out of position with the, you know, going for the shot block, so that's something to watch, but a lot of that is, you know, penetration from the guards and how well can they sort of stay in front of their men. That stuff is hard to judge until you get, because that, a lot of that is, you know, team oriented. It's not like individual defense is great, but playing team defense is so much more important. And it's really hard to sort of predict how that's going to play out until you get those guys on the court and get them, you know, sort of working together.
If I tell you Ben Carter is the best rebounder on this team, and I tell you UNLV has similar struggles on the defensive boards next year, how much more playing time do you give him over, say, Zimmerman or Okonobo, even if he's not really the offensive threat that Steven Zimmerman might be?
I don't think that would happen. I would see him taking minutes away from Okonobo before he's taking significant minutes away from Zimmerman. Like Okonobo, you may sacrifice some of the rim protection and shot blocking to get a better handle on the defensive rebounds. Like, I could see this making that swap, but I think Zimmerman's pretty safe.
If, like, what is, let's say Steven Zimmerman's a 12, 13 point guy next year and he shoots at a pretty good percentage, like, how bad of a defensive rebounder, how bad of a rebounder would he have to be for him to, like, lose some significant minutes?
It would have to be A.J. West every game. Like, it would have to get to that level. It would have to be like they're playing A.J. West every game.
Because, yeah, I kind of view the same thing, just because if he's going to be that good offensively, and that's just pure speculation, but if he is a 12 and 13 guy and you know, he's your third option still, I do think, like, you don't take that out just because you're giving up rebounds and you try to solve that somewhere else. Because, to be fair, I mean, UNLV wasn't a good rebounding team, but they had a good rebounding performance against Utah, had a good rebounding performance against Arizona. Rashad Vaughn at one point in conference play was their second best defensive rebounder by percentage. Like, they had a bad season rebounding, but there were times where, like, they looked like a good rebounding team. They fixed it for a couple games. They got Rashad Vaughn. So I think you kind of look for other places. You say, hey, Ike Wamu, go in there and grab some rebounds, you bowling ball. That's what you sort of look for rather than benching Steven Zimmerman. But I don't know how good Zimmerman is going to be as a rebounder.
I would expect him to be somewhere around a double-double guy. Just because ever since Rice has been here, that whoever's playing power forward for them ends up as a double-double guy. You know, whether like Moser and then Bennett, and then Roscoe Smith and then Wood last year, like whoever they plug in a power forward seems to put up those kind of numbers. So like, I would expect him to, you know, be in that same range. I don't know if that's going to be, he's an effective rebounder, but just in terms of like raw stats, I would expect him around, you know, double-double.
What does, for Steven Zimmerman to be labeled a bust as a freshman, what is his points and rebound stat line have to be?
It'd have to be like under five, like somewhere around there. Like,
so like if he was like a four, so if he was getting 6 points and five rebounds a game, you think he'd still not be kind of considered a bust?
He wouldn't be a superstar. He wouldn't be like a one and done freshman superstar. But like, I don't think the pitchforks would be out if he's a 6 and 5 guy.
Like, because I kind of look at it and I say, if he's getting 8 points and six rebounds and UNLV is four games above 500, people are going to be yelling at Dave Rice, obviously, but I feel like Steven Zimmerman would be getting quite a bit of blame from that as well.
I could see it. But I think Dave Rice would take, I think Rice would get most of the criticism.
And I do
think Zimmerman is just insulated because of who he is and like how much they put into get. I don't think I can't see the city like or the fans like turning on him after 1 year.
Not Chris Wood style.
Yeah, that's I don't think that would happen with Zimmerman.
He's too nice on Twitter, huh? He's not trolling UNLV fans on Twitter.
People feel like they know him. They're like invested in him.
Okay, scholarships left. It's two, right?
Yeah.
Justin Jackson reclassifying could be one, and then even if he does, they still have an open scholarship.
Yeah.
Got to get a big guy.
Although with Nuamu committed now and playing that and giving them another wing guy, I don't know how much they would. How hard they would press Justin Jackson to reclassify. It doesn't look like they would need him on the wing this year, so they may be content to let him play out another high school season, another prep season, and then bring him in.
So two scholarships left, could be Justin Jackson, could not be. How important, like, I think it's pretty important to get another big guy just because I want Dwayne Morgan as far away from power forward minutes as possible, but you kind of mentioned it last time. You don't just go get a big man to get a big man. If there's no, like, capable big man out there, you don't just give a big man a contract, a scholarship, because he's 6'11" or whatever. Like, what do you kind of see is balancing maybe getting a big guy who's your fourth big man versus maybe leaving a scholarship open and maybe you get a midseason transfer or something like that?
Honestly, I'm not sure. I know that Dave Rice, he's open to going into the season with open scholarships. Like, he's open to that. That's a big problem for him. If that's how it plays out, I think he's okay with doing that. It's worked out for the team in the past. The question is, like, the quality at this point in the recruiting process, in terms of, like, out of players who are going to be eligible next year, whether they're transfers or class of 2015 high schoolers or someone from the JUCO who's going to be eligible, are you going to find a quality guy this late in the recruiting process that you can plug in even as your fourth big man and expect decent minutes from?
As far as I know, UNLV is not, like, rumored to be in the mix for any other transfers. Like, you don't know of any transfers that UNLV is interested in or the player has interest in UNLV.
No, unless there's someone on, like, the JUCO level that they're working on or someone that they're keeping their eye on that level. For Division I, out of guys who would be eligible next year, I can't think of any. I haven't heard anything.
Okay. Oh, yeah, there's two scholarships left. It feels like they have a good roster, so it's not like you look at it and say they need this, but it's still two scholarships left, and you want to be playing with, a full deck of cards, like, unlike they were this past season. All right, so completely changing gears. We're going to talk about boring sports. So the last 45, 60 days, college basketball was called boring and awful. Chelsea, if you pay attention to English soccer, they have now won the Premier League, but they were also called boring for the way they play. Floyd Mayweather, who's the greatest boxer of this era, called boring after people. Did you pay for the fight, Mike?
I watched the fight.
Did you you bought it? Did you pay $100 yourself for it?
I watched it. No, I paid for it.
Okay, that's. I didn't. I've never cared about boxing, and so
did you scope it.
Before it started, I was sort of watching it on Periscope, and I saw, like, Manny Pacquiao walk into a song that he wrote and sang, which I thought was hilarious. I saw that much on Periscope, but it was too much of people's streams either ending it on purpose or they're losing connection, and I just said I don't care that much, and I saw plenty of it on Twitter as I sat in bed. But I didn't actually see, like, any of the actual fighting itself. I just know people complained about it being boring. But
there was not a lot of actual fighting.
I mean, I've never cared about boxing before. I think it was, like, two nights ago. I can't remember what channel, but they were showing, like, Mayweather's last 10 fights or something in a row, or 5 fights in a row. And I watched, like, 2 rounds, and I was like, this is not entertaining
at
all.
Do you think of a worse way to spend, like, a Friday night? Are you kidding me? You sit down and watch 10 Floyd Mayweather fights?
I didn't watch all of them. I was on and I turned it on because I was like, hey, there's a lot of people caring about boxing. And it was like, I watched 2 or 3 rounds and I was like, this is not that entertaining. And then I changed the channel to, I think it was rugby in Australia because that was live at 11 o'clock at night. But basically boring sports. So I want to ask you this. Floyd Mayweather, undefeated. Chelsea, if you pay attention to soccer, they won the Premier League, both called boring. Does it matter if you're boring and win?
If you're a fan of the person of the team or the person doing the winning, then no, you don't care. That may, you may even take pleasure in the fact that your team is boring. But like for it's more about being a casual fan, as you know I am, and a lot I feel like most of the people who got sucked in by the hype of Mayweather-Pacquiao are probably casual boxing fans at best. So a lot of times people, casual fans, it's harder to appreciate, you know, the finer, you know, the nuances of the sport. And when you're not, you know, enjoying the nuance, if you don't pick up on the nuances, you're not really getting the sense of, you know, how good a performance it is, and then it just seems boring.
I don't think, like, it doesn't matter. If you're winning, it doesn't matter as long as your sport is popular. And, like, if you take soccer, which is actually has multiple layers to it, because in England, it's like the Premier League is everything to them. So it doesn't matter that Chelsea's boring. People are still going to watch. But, like, America is caring more about soccer, but they're still trying to get, you know, more soccer fans in America. It does matter because they're trying to grow it, and you don't want to sit and watch a team that just plays defensively and tries to win a game 1-0, like is what Chelsea is accused of doing and what they have done their last, like, 10 or 11 games or something like that. So it doesn't matter if your sport is popular, but it does matter if you're trying to gain fans. And that's, like, what this Mayweather-Pacquiao thing was. I mean, this is the most attention boxing has had in my lifetime, or at least since I've been old enough to remember about boxing. Like, I don't ever, and maybe it's because I live in Las Vegas now, but I don't ever remember, like, thinking, oh, my God, I have to watch a boxing. You know, I've never had that thought, and I did, even as I wasn't watching it and said I don't care about boxing, I did have the thought of, oh, maybe I should watch it. But, like, it was the biggest boxing match ever, and now people are like, that was awful. I can't believe I spent $100. I can't believe they got paid, you know, $180 million, whatever the hell it was, for that. Boxing needed it to be an exciting fight, and it wasn't. Now, to kind of take this into football, because to me, football can withstand it in America. Like, if you take college football a couple years ago, Alabama and LSU played a 9-6 regular season game that was, like, all hyped up as this is the greatest game of the year and this is the game of the century, even though there's 1,000 games of the century. It ended 9-6, and then they got a rematch in the national title game, and it was 21-0, and LSU didn't cross midfield. Like, both of those were horrendous football games. And if you were trying to get someone into football, they would be like, this is ridiculously stupid.
And yet, you know, sort of the way that you enjoy watching, you know, basketball teams play defense, and you say you can take enjoyment out of a low-scoring game as long as it's played well. You know, there are a lot of football fans who,
yes,
who have in-depth knowledge of football and sort of enjoy watching a defense that's that good that they can shut teams down sort of at will. And they understand the nuances of how defense is played and what makes it such an impressive performance. So you can draw some enjoyment from that.
Yes. And now the 9-6 game, like, it was still tough. Like, even if you enjoy defensive football, that was like, all right, guys, we gotta get one in the end zone at least one of these times. But football is so popular in America, and specifically the southeast part of the country where Alabama and LSU are, that it didn't matter. Like, those were still two huge games, extremely popular, and it was, oh, defensive football is the way to go, and Cardell Jones ran a truck through that this past season. But football is so popular that it doesn't matter if there's a boring game that's the biggest game of the year, because there's going to be critics, but it's still people are going to watch it and they're going to come back. But football to me is perfect for, like, 2015 and perfect for how we watch sports, because Mike, how many sporting events do you watch where you don't have either your laptop or your phone and you're checking something else, whether it be related to the game? Like, how many times do you sit down and it's you and the TV to watch the sporting event and that's
like
it?
Like, none. Like, I turned my phone off for, like, Mayweather-Pacquiao, but I still had, like, my computer open.
Yeah, like, the only time that I, like, watch sports and not paying attention to anything else is, like, maybe if the Packers are in the playoffs And if it's like I wake up at 5 o'clock to watch a soccer game in England and there's just nothing that's actually happening for me to look at. Like, those are really the only two times where I'm not paying as much attention to my phone or my computer as I am to the actual game. But football is perfect because it's like a bite-sized. Like, you've got a 10-second play, and then you've got 20 seconds where you can look down at Twitter. You can check your fantasy football team or whatever else it is, and then look back up, watch 10 seconds, and then straight back down again. Like, it's absolutely perfect, even if you're the person that doesn't want to pay attention to Twitter or doesn't do fantasy football and you just want to watch football. There's plenty going on in terms of formation and substitutions before the next snap that you can sit and watch it, even though there's kind of nothing happening, and still be entertained for the 20 seconds between plays. So to me, like football, the rhythm is football is perfect for how we watch sports now. Basketball's not, baseball's not, soccer's not, but football is absolutely perfect for the way we watch sports in 2015.
Yeah, football, for the way we watch it now, it is good because you can have your computer out, you can be checking your fantasy, you can be, group texting with friends, you can be, on Twitter, you can be doing all that stuff and, not miss anything. My problem with football is that, I can't just watch one game at a time because of all the downtime, like in between plays. Like, football has gotten like the pace of everything else surrounding the game has sped up so much that it makes the game seem slow.
If I'm
sitting down like on a Monday night for Monday Night Football or whatever, and that's the only football game on, then it seems like excruciatingly slow.
you need the Sunday of five games.
Yes.
Whenever I watch NFL on Sunday, I'll usually have one game on, but then I'm probably paying more attention to my fantasy tracker and paying attention like to just words and numbers popping up to tell me what my running back just did than I am the actual game. So it's like, I understand what you're saying. Like, I usually don't watch multiple NFL games at the same time, but I'll have one on and I'm paying attention to what's happening in the other ones because I care what my wide receiver just did in the second quarter of a game that I don't even get in Las Vegas or whatever it is. I think the rhythm of it is perfect. Soccer is 45 minutes and like, it's great for that. It's 45 minutes. There's no commercials and like you don't stop. But it's also not a lot of scoring, and you do have to pay attention for 45 straight minutes, and it's not great. Baseball is too slow. Like, if you could guarantee that the ball would be put in play on every single pitch, like, baseball would almost have the rhythm thing down perfectly, because it's sort of similar to football in that there's time between each pitch, but you have too many pitches. You have too many 17-pitch at-bats or 7-pitch at-bats that it's like, I can miss four pitches and not miss anything, but then I'll miss the fifth one and it'll be a home run. So baseball's off there. But to kind of bring this back around to UNLV and Dave Rice, he kind of gets criticized for how he plays defensively because he kind of plays more, doesn't play an aggressive defense, it's a passive defense, doesn't, pressure on the ball, pressure the passing lanes and all that. It gets compared a lot to Tarkanian and the way he played defense, which is a lot more pressing. And I've only seen one full Jerry Tarkanian coach game. It was the national title game against Duke, and it was a lot of fun to watch. But does it matter the way Dave Rice, if his defense is boring, if his coaching style is, like, does that ultimately matter to you? Because I don't actually think people complain about Dave Rice because what they watch is boring. I think they just complain because it doesn't work for
them. I think it's results-based. Like, if it works, fans will be happy with it. Like, Ben Howland, who was like the rumored guy that they were going to bring in to replace him. Like, he plays the most, for casual fans, the most quote unquote boring style that you can play. But, when he's taking, the team to the Final Four, every year for, three straight years, like, no one's complaining.
It's got to be hard to play boring basketball when you get Russell Westbrook and Kevin Love, right?
Exactly.
Like, it's hard to make Russell Westbrook boring as a basketball
player.
Yeah. Like, he kind of dismisses that by himself. But if you can get accused of boring basketball with Russell Westbrook on your team, that's like an accomplishment. You should kind of be proud of that. But I don't know. It's all results driven in terms of UNLV fans. Now, obviously, college basketball is under a whole different storm of hell because of how terrible it is, apparently. But with Dave Rice, I don't think it matters. I would like to see them be more aggressive just because it is more entertaining, and I think that Pat McCall could be the best player in the Mountain West by far if they just let him do whatever he wanted defensively. But I don't know. It's ultimately sports are meant to be entertaining, so I am in favor if leagues or whatever want to put in rules that try to make it more entertaining because it is entertainment. If they want to make it faster paced, want to make it more scoring like that, I will always be okay with that, and I'll never think, oh, they're ruining the game.
Yeah, like, I think it's fine. Like, if they're winning, it's no one's going to be complaining about entertainment value. Like, you get more entertainment. If you go to a game, you get more entertainment from a win than you would from the most exciting loss.
Yeah, absolutely. No doubt about it. All right. Last part of the show. I guess I will be the one that is annoyed today. We were both kind of complaining about things. But I've got a few things, actually, that are not major things, but they're smaller things. The first one is coaches do this all the time. Players sort of do it, and media does it a lot. And it's when you have the Mountain West Conference or the Southeastern Conference or the National Basketball Association, when you have people that refer to those as leagues, it annoys the hell out of me because they're not leagues, they're conferences. Like when a coach is talking about Mountain West Conference and he says, you know, we're into league play, I'm like, it's not a league, it's a conference.
I gotta disagree with you there.
You disagree.
It's not that big of a deal to me. In fact, I gotta say I'm a culprit. Like, I'll call it a league. I mean,
I hate that so much.
Here's the thing. I don't want to write the word conference like 5 times in one paragraph. You know, it just looks it looks bad if you say the same word over and over again. So you got to call it a conference. You have to call it a league. You have to you have to come up with like some synonyms.
You can't say the same word
over and over again.
Yes, you can. You can say Mountain West play. You can say conference play, and just go back and forth between the two. It's all you have to do. It's not a if you want it to be a league, go call it like the Horizon League did and be the Mountain West League. No, it's a conference. You don't have the league player of the year. You don't have league games. You have conference games.
No, I'm calling poetic license.
No.
I'm calling poetic license. We can call it a league if we want to.
And like the NBA does it too, even though it's not a league, it's the association. These are, you know, it annoys me because they're not leagues. And it's like coaches in every conference do it. They'll call them league games. Like Andy Kennedy, the coach I covered at Ole Miss, he did it all the time, and that's where I hated it. That's where this grew from, is Andy Kennedy calling them league games and crap like that. They're not league games. They're conference games. This is the Southeastern Conference. But I hated it so much because it's not a league. Because it's like you have Major League Baseball. That's a league. The American League is a league.
What is the technical difference between a league and a conference?
I don't have any idea, and I don't really care, but you chose to name it the Mountain West Conference. Well, maybe not you, but it was called the Mountain West Conference, so it is a conference game.
Maybe I don't want to pull up the definitions on, you know, dictionary.com right now, but
I'm sure they're the same.
If the words can mean both, like if they both fit the words, why can't they be both?
Because you didn't name it the league, you named it the conference.
I think you're crazy.
It annoys the hell out of me. All right, I got another.
You're way off on that
thing.
One. What's the next one?
No, the next one is when it comes to pro sports and when it comes to like announcers or reporters or whoever anointing certain pro stadiums the loudest one in the NFL or in the NBA because it changes like every 3 years, and it's so funny. It just happens to be the best team in that league.
You know what
league.
I love about those pieces? It's always some sideline reporter standing down like there before the game or during a loud portion of the game. And the official like measuring stick for how loud a stadium is like jet engines. Like every time they bring up how loud a stadium is, they always say, oh, it's X amount of decibels, which would be equal to like 2 jet engines. It's like, I don't know how loud a jet engine is. I've never stood like directly in front of a jet engine like that. It's such a weird, I don't know why, how that became like the default measuring unit for stadium loudness, but I do find it funny.
Like, I am sure that the Golden State Warriors have had a great fan base for, I don't know how long they've been a team, but for a long time. But all of a sudden, they've got the loudest crowd in the NBA, and it just so happens that they've got the best team in the NBA, too. Like I can remember, I'm a Houston Astros fan. The Astros went to the World Series, like, in 2004, and they got swept. At that point in time, the Houston Astros were referred to as the loudest stadium in baseball. Now they get, like, 10 people to show up for their games, even though they've won 10 straight and they've got the most wins in Major League Baseball. But they only get, like, 1,000 people to show up to their games now. But it annoys the hell out of me, because it's like, no, they don't have some great fan base. They just have a great team, and they decided to show up now, and it happens like that across sports. I can remember the Kansas City Chiefs. It was like, oh, this is like a college football game going to play at Arrowhead Stadium. Yeah, they were good. They won like 14 games one year. Like, they were a good team. Of course they've got a lot of fans and they're loud because they're good. It's annoying.
Any team that the loudest team is usually whatever team is in the playoffs at the time, and that is winning, because people make a lot of noise when they're winning.
All right, I got one more for you, and this is in the this is an NBA special.
You were good on the last. The last one was valid. I'll get that one as well.
Okay. This is an NBA special. All right, it's twofold. The first thing, I get really annoyed with players that want to shoot, like, 30 seconds after the whistle. Like, the whistle blows, and they're like, all right, I'm going to shoot it now. Like, it wouldn't bother me if it happened every so often, but it literally happens every time there's a whistle and somebody has the ball in their hands. They shoot it. Like, every single time. It's like, do you have to shoot it? No, you don't. That annoys me. What really annoys me, though, is defenders blocking those shots.
You don't like the goaltend? The game's...
No, I hate that so much. Like, just forget, like, it doesn't matter. Like, for whatever reason, they're like, I gotta intimidate him. I can't let him see a shot go in, blah, blah, blah. I gotta go poke this ball from my hand through the rim and out. I hate that much.
I don't know if it's I can't decide if it's valid or not yet, but I'm kind of biased because it was vaguely annoying at one point, but then I'm a Boston Celtics fan, and
Kevin Garnett did it 90,000 times.
And once he started doing it, I loved it more than anything else. Like, just because that it for something so dumb, you can tell that it does annoy opposing players. Like, when you start goaltending their shots after the whistle. Like, for some
Didn't
reason,
somebody that, hurt their hand on the net.
For some reason, it gets under players' skin, and if you can do something to get under their skin, like, hey, go and do it.
Oh no, I hate it. Like, I want to, like, stab people that do that. I'm like, just stop it. Go to your damn huddle. Your coach called a timeout. He wants to tell you what to do. He doesn't want you to block the shot and break your finger in the net. Like, it's awful.
But you also don't like the guy shooting after the whistle. So
don't like. But see, that was like I'm not super pissed about that. It's just that it's just that everybody does it is what annoys me the most. But what do I propose? Like, if there's a whistle, and you shoot it too late after the whistle, you like the other team gets a free throw.
Well, I think it's probably you can call a delay of game. It's probably within the referee's discretion to call a delay of game if they want to.
Absolutely, I am okay with that. And two delay of games is a technical.
No, but the best way to deal with it is to take matters into your own hands, like Kevin Garnett does, and just stand up there and knock those shots away, and then people will stop doing it.
Just get, like, did these guys not play, like, middle school basketball where your coaches tell you to hand, YMCA basketball where your coaches tell you to hand it to the ref?
I don't know. If I could get above the rim, I would take every opportunity to do so. I would be swatting everything.
I just, like, God, I just want to, like, it annoys me so much. Like, I want people to get. I want them to break their fingers on the rim when they do that.
You think that's going to stop it?
If like six people broke their fingers on the rims, yeah, I think people would stop.
Two NFL players tore their ACLs celebrating a sack last season. Two, and people are still going to be celebrating sacks.
Well, see, that's because it's like fat guys that are really excited they did something and they've worked hard on their celebrations and they're proud of those. Like, they're not going to stop that. This is not anything to be proud of. This is just, I want to be a douchebag and keep you from making a shot that doesn't
injuries
count.
Are not going to stop athletes from doing it because no one thinks that it's going to happen to them. Like, no one thinks that they're – no one is going to line up after-the-whistle goaltend and then say, oh, maybe I shouldn't because I might get hurt. Like, that's not –
No. I'm aware the player's not going to think that, but hopefully their coach will say, stop doing that. So-and-so over in the Eastern Conference just broke his finger on the rest.
I would like to see the NBA coach that goes up to – that has a team meeting and tells them that they're not allowed to do that. NBA coaches are basically empty suits anyway. Like, the players run that league.
Steve Kerr could tell somebody on the Warriors not to do it.
What's that?
Steve Kerr could tell somebody on the – Steve Kerr's the biggest person on the Warriors.
I will say.
Like, he could tell somebody not to do it.
If you think he could tell Andrew Bogut to not to goaltend shots after the whistle and Andrew Bogut would
Steve
care
Kerr
about that?
Hell yeah, he could. Yeah, Steve Kerr could.
Andrew Bogut is on like a $70 million contract. Steve Kerr is like, even if he's the highest paid coach in the league, he makes like 1/10 of that.
Well, it doesn't matter. Steve Kerr has far exceeded Andrew Bogut's playing career.
I feel like any like smart NBA coach realizes that the balance of power is with the players. I don't think he would pay. I don't think. Why would you make that into an issue? Just
because you don't want him to break his finger. You want him to keep playing and be able to shoot a free throw.
I think you're off on this one. This one I'm going to deem not annoying.
Oh, Mike, you're the
worst. You were 1 out of 3. You were 1 for 3 this week.
I was better than 1 for 3. I nailed all 3 of those. Don't you? I think you're going to call them league games on purpose, and I'm going to.
I say that look, when you're talking about it. I'm not. I don't want to use this. I take some pride in my writing. Like, I don't want to say conference like 5 times in a row. Like, you need some variety.
How many times have you had to write conference 4 times in a paragraph?
Need some variety. Like, if guy wins, you say, hey, he was the conference player of the year. He scored this many points per game in conference play. His best game in conference play came against this team. Like,
you don't have to say that.
You're already done with it.
No, listen. You just throw one Mountain West play in there, and you're good to go.
But I just said he was like the Mountain West Conference player of the year. You want me to say now he's
Mountain West Conference Player of the Year. Then in conference play, he averaged blank, and his best game against a Mountain West opponent was blank, and you're good to
that's
go.
That's an awful sentence.
No, it's not. It's no. Well, it's better than calling it a damn league game.
I would redline that and put league in there so fast.
And I would not change it. I would say, nope, it's not a league. It's not. It's really not a league. If you wanted it to be a league, you'd call it a league. The only conference that gets to do that is the Horizon League. I am perfectly okay if the Horizon League called it like conference games. Because if you look it up, like, the conference champion gets the automatic qualifying or automatic berth in the NCAA tournament. And it's called, like, if you go to ESPN.com and you're like NCAA teams and you're like sort by conference, like, I'm okay if the Horizon League calls it conference games and league games, but the Mountain West Conference cannot call it conference games and league games because in no way is it the Mountain, like, it's not a league at all.
I'm going to allow it. I'm going to keep going.
Does Dave Rice say league games? I don't think I've heard him say league games.
I don't know. Dave Rice is, usually sports impeccable grammar. I don't know if you've noticed that.
I remember him complaining about some reporter that misquoted him and like used it wasn't like an awful misquoting.
No, like he said you and me, and someone quoted him as saying like you and I.
Yeah.
He was pretty adamant. Like, I would never say that because like I know the correct grammar for it.
Yeah, he was going on about like you can say I'm a terrible coach and you can say I suck, but don't misquote me to use improper grammar.
Yeah. Like, I'm pretty sure he has a better grasp of grammar than I do.
Okay. Well, this has been the Towel Boys covering UNLV, which plays in the Mountain West Conference. He is Mike Grimala over at runrebs.com. I'm Tyler Bischoff over here at Mountain West Connection. For Mike, thank you for tuning in.